Good morning. Welcome to North Dakota Public Service Commission. It is 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 25th, 2012. This is, as I said, the North Dakota PSC. We're meeting today on the 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck. And it's time and place for our regular biweekly meeting. This is Commission Chairman Tony Clark. I'd like to welcome everyone today. Allow my fellow commissioners to introduce themselves.
Good morning. Welcome, everybody. And it's got to be worth noting. Ward, welcome. Ward Ugrud is with us from Otter Tail today, along with half of Fergus Falls, near as I can tell. But most important is that Ward is actually really retiring on Monday, and that's so we're glad that you'd spend this time with us down the home stretch. Congratulations, you've earned the break.
And good morning, Brian Culk, and welcome to the crew as well.
With that, we do have some items on consent.
I'd move passage of consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Moving to items in my portfolio, TC1, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing first amended corridor certificate number 121 and route permit number 144 to Minkota Power Cooperative, Inc., authorizing construction of its proposed 345 kV electric transmission line from Center to Grand Forks, North Dakota, case number PU-09-670.
Second.
This is a significant case, and it's a significant line. This line is the largest one that's been permitted by the commission in probably three decades or so, at least since the 1970s. It's a 345 kV line, approximately 250 miles long, all contained within North Dakota. This would be the final step for approval of the project. It's proposed to be built by Minkota, so it has not needed to have a certificate of public convenience and necessity, but it is a permitted project nonetheless. As I indicated, it's about 250 miles long. It extends and is intended to hook up the Minkota service territory with the Milton R. Young Unit 2 generating station, which is located near the town of Center, North Dakota. The transmission line will run from Center to Grand Forks, which is in the heart of Minkota's service territory. The need for the project is both to allow access to that particular generating station, but also as a reliability measure. The commission learned through the course of a number of hearings about reliability needs in the northern part of the Red River Valley. There is a less robust transmission system in that part of the state, and so this will help provide some additional grid reliability in and around the Minkota service territory, especially in the Northern Valley. This is a project that has a bit of a federal nexus because it's funded by the Rural Utilities Service. There was a requirement for an environmental assessment, and the project did receive on February of this year a finding of no significant impact on the federal side. The majority of this project will be using single-pole construction, which is typically what's done in these larger lines now, folks will probably notice around the country. So they have a smaller footprint than a lot of the old H-frame or latticework ones that people may be used to with the larger utility lines. Rather, they're single-pole, self-supporting, self-weatherizing steel structures, and they'll range from 95 to 180 feet, and the typical span will be about 1,000 feet. Where there is a little bit of deviation from this is there is a Missouri River crossing, which will be using specialized three-pole steel structures, and then near the Grand Forks International Airport, two H-frame wood structures will be, wood or steel structures will be used, and the heights of those are a little bit shorter on the H-frames, approximately 62 feet near the airport for obvious reasons, and near the Missouri River crossing, they'll be a bit bigger, 205 feet. None of the structures will require guy wires. The total project cost is estimated to be $312 million, which actually, if you consider the number of miles, that's actually a pretty impressive feat. Other parts of the country, transmission line, building transmission line, especially sizable transmission like a 345, would cost significantly more. $312 puts it somewhat over $1 million a mile. As far as the route criteria that the commission looks at, for a project as big as it is, 250 miles long, it's actually surprising how few impacts there are, which would indicate that they selected a fairly good route. There are 9 occupied or vacant but occupiable residences within 500 feet of the project, which would be considered an avoidance area. However, the commission does allow the utility to obtain written waivers from owners of these types of residences, and those have been obtained in all cases. There were a few areas that needed to be avoided or at least mitigated, cultural resource areas, wildlife management areas, things like that, but they were all successfully done so. I would just indicate the commission has had a number of hearings throughout the course of this particular proceeding, 6 altogether, if you take into account both the corridor and route portions of it. And we heard from a lot of landowners during those 6 hearings. I think they were worthwhile and proved the value of the type of process that we have in North Dakota. I would separate the landowner concerns that we heard into basically 2 buckets. One were specific concerns about the corridor route. Typically, these tended to be landowners who maybe in a lot of cases didn't even oppose the project, might be generally supportive of the project, but would come to the commission and say, look, I'd rather have it on this side of the field than this side of the field, or if it's going to enter my land, I'd rather that it be on this section as opposed to this section. And in many of those cases, through the process, the utility was able to be responsive to those concerns. And so I think it does prove the value of this sort of process where you're actually in the communities, having hearings in the communities where these projects will go. And the company was responsive to those, and the commission was as well through our siting process. There was another bucket which where you had concerns, oftentimes legitimate concerns that landowners raised, but were things that the commission couldn't really address. I mean, it might have issues related to compensation or just utility lines in general, or folks who maybe don't like transmission lines, or people who don't mind them but would rather have them upgraded so more wind could get on. Lots of things like that, but we're really outside of commission jurisdiction. Nonetheless, we appreciate hearing concerns that the people may wish to bring to us. One of the things that the commission will be doing after this sometime after this meeting, will be hiring on a third-party inspector. We've talked about this through the course of our work sessions. We do have funds available through our siting fee money to be able to do it. These are people who are basically our boots on the ground, our eyes and ears, making sure that as this project is being constructed, that the commission's order is being adhered to by the utility company to the degree that landowners then have concerns about really anything that's going on with the construction practices or even post-construction follow-up, things like that. We'll have a better handle of that. We'll have someone that we can work with directly and who can work with landowners directly as well. Because of state procurement procedures, we're not able to do that as part of this order. We've started that process, and we'll be issuing an RFQ so that can happen. But please know that that's something that the commission will also be doing, especially given the fact that this is a greenfield site. This is not previously sited land. It's a brand-new line. It's a large line. It's, as I said, 250 miles long, and it's the largest and longest and biggest line that we've permitted since the 1970s. So that's why we place a great deal of emphasis on that. And with that, I'll turn to my fellow commissioners.
You've described it beautifully.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I would add is that of all the things that we do in the commission, I will tell you that transmission lines are by far the most complex and the most controversial. And one of the things that I really noticed in the process was we did the 3 corridor hearings and we did the route hearings. But one of the things that I think that the commission can improve on as well as all of us is the information flow. Because when they come out with where all the corridors are going to be, everybody who is potentially impacted gets very, very concerned very quickly. But as you narrow down to which corridor you pick, a lot of those concerns drop off, and even in the route hearings. So anything we can do that as the process narrows down to what the actual route is going to be to inform people, to get the right people to come to those hearings, to get their right concerns, I think is going to be absolutely crucial going forward. But overall, I thought it went very well considering the length and the complexity.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Item TC2 has been withdrawn. We've added that to our administrative agenda so we can schedule a work session to discuss a proposed order. TC3, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing certificate of site compatibility number 29 to Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC, authorizing construction of its proposed 102-megawatt New Frontier wind energy project in McHenry County, North Dakota, case number PU-11-69.
Second.
Metalark has indicated that the project's going to have a nameplate capacity of approximately 102 megawatts, and they're assuming very good net capacity factors in this farm of approximately 54%. The number of turbines that will actually be employed is still yet to be determined. They're considering six different turbine designs, and depending on how large they are, it'll either be somewhere on the low end at 44 turbines, at the high end, 63 turbines. Metalark has indicated that they would potentially begin construction as soon as the second quarter of 2012 or in 2013, depending on the status of the federal production tax credits and the market for the electricity to be generated. This project does not currently have a customer to purchase the power from the project. Total construction costs are approximately $200 million. A couple of the concerns that the commission vetted through the course of the hearing. This field is close to some U.S. Air Force facilities. Whenever we're in that part of the state, we always ask about that, and the Department of Defense did indicate that this should avoid any impacts on their facilities and operations. No wind turbine is going to be placed within 1,400 feet of any occupied residence. We always look at noise and shadow flicker. In all cases, it is below the general rules of thumb that the commission has used in past siting cases, so there really is no concern with that. Other than that, looks like a pretty straightforward application.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC 4, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-12-159, canceling warehouse license number 1074 to Dakota Midland Grain LLC at Minot, North Dakota, and effect an order ordering that business at Minot is discontinued effective immediately.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I would just note on that, the facility was damaged during the 2011 flood, and due to the extremely high cost to bring the elevator back to its pre-flood conditions, the board of directors voted to discontinue business at the Minot facility. It's empty, and there are no outstanding storage obligations. With that, Commissioner Kalk.
Good morning. Items BK 1, 2, and 3 are combined. I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing concerning Dakota Central Telecom One, Inc.'s switched access price schedule, case number PU-1262, Dakota Central Telecommunication Cooperative switched access price schedule, case number PU-1263, and Beck Communications Cooperative switched access price schedule, case number PU-12-104.
Second.
Basically, what we have is that in February of 2012, Dakota Central and Dakota Central Telecommunications Cooperative filed with the North Dakota PSC a new price schedule to reflect newly enacted federal communication rules regarding the treatment of VoIP traffic. Pursuant to the FCC order, these new rules became effective December 29th of last year. We suspended both of those price schedules in anticipation of scheduling some type of hearing. And later on, March 5th, we also received Beck Communication filed with the North Dakota PSC, their new price schedule. So what we have is we're going to, by anyone requesting a hearing, needs to let us know by close of business on May 17th, 2012, to determine the impact of this price schedule and what the appropriate next step is. Basically, this is to come in compliance with the new FCC order, and we have a role as the state telecom folks.
All in favor?
Aye.
Item BK4. I move the commission adopt the order granting Capital Building One Bismarck LLC's petition to Master Meter Electric Services, case number PU-12-135.
Second.
In April of this year, Capital Building One Bismarck, a subsidiary of Lexstar Construction, petitioned to have a master meter to install Master Meter Electric Services at a 29,000-foot square office building to be constructed in North Bismarck. North Dakota Administration Code generally prohibits master metering, but provides the commission may approve a petition for master metering if the owner or builder effectively demonstrates to the satisfaction of the commission that the cost of purchasing and installing meters is no longer benefits the actual individual customers. So we got together with the folks, and it looks like the cost savings by doing master metering will be around $13,000. And The most of the tenants in this small building, it'll be subject to change, rapid growth, and downsizing. As a result, Capitol Building 1 expects that configuring the office spaces to better meet the needs of tenants and separate meeting would result in additional costs for rewiring. Also, they're installing a high energy efficiency heating and cooling system, which will better work actually in this system if it has master metering. Having looked at this, I think that's the right idea, and I would even, we've talked to my colleagues about it, but perhaps we go back and change the rules on this. So with that, I'll be recommending approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Item BK5. I move the Commission adopt the order concerning Otter Tail Power Company's transmission facility cost recovery tariff, case number PU11682, and Otter Tail Power Company's transmission facility cost recovery rates, case number PU11-153.
Second.
In April of 2011, Otter Tail filed an application with the PSC for approval of a tariff that would provide for the recovery of investment and associated costs for new or modified transmission facilities that are not included in Otter Tail Power's general rate schedule and for charges through the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, MISO, cost through Schedule 26 of the appropriate section. In November, the Commission issued a notice of filing, notice of hearing, and notice of intervention deadlines. In December of 2011, the Commission granted North Dakota Large Industrial Group's request to intervene. The Large Industrial Group is made up of Goodrich Corporation, Cargill Corporation, Cavendish Farms, Archer Daniel Midland Company, Comdale Innovation, and Tharaldson Ethanol, as well as Enbridge Energy. In January of 24th, we held a hearing, evidentiary hearing in the Commission. The projects that are actually involved are Bemidji to Grand Rapids, which is a 230 kV, and the Fargo to Monticello's Phase 1, 2, and 3 projects, which are 345 kV. Otter Tail is a 20% investor in the Bemidji to Grand Rapids project and a 13.2% investor in the Fargo to Monticello projects. Otter Tail's investment in these projects is larger than the share of costs associated to Otter Tail's retail customers through the MISO tariff. For the Bemidji project, Otter Tail has allocated 61.25% of the cost, and for the Fargo projects, 80.38% of the cost. Otter Tail proposes that the rider rates are based upon the cost projected over the recovery period, and the revenue requirement is based on the demand allocation factor and rate of return established in Otter Tail's most recent rate case. In November of 2011, Otter Tail filed supplemental attachments that reflected two alternative methods for calculating the rider rates, referred to as the split method and the all-in method. For the split method, the retail rate base amount and the revenue credit are proportional to the amount of costs allocated to Otter Tail through the MISO tariff. For the all-in method, the retail rate base amount and the revenue credits are based on the entire Otter Tail Power investment in the project. The split method does not increase the retail rate base in excess of what is required to serve Otter Tail retail customers, and therefore retail customers are not exposed unnecessarily to changes in the MISO revenues, which over the period of the project are certainly expected to change. With respect to treatment of Otter Tail's investment in regional transmission projects, those that have qualified for cost allocations through MISO, I believe that the split method reduces the risk to the ratepayer and is more consistent with traditional rate-making principles, and therefore I think the split method is what we should use to determine these investments. If approved, this will become effective May 1st of this year, and September 1st of each year, Otter Tail shall file with the Commission an annual TCR rider rate on a going-forward basis in their annual filing to make sure if there's any overages or underages that they're trued up at that time.
All in favor?
Aye.
And finally, item BK6. I move the Commission issue a notice of hearing in the complaint of North Central Electric Cooperative versus Otter Tail Power Company regarding the provision of electric service to the Sky Dancer Hotel and Casino on the Turtle Mountain Reservation, case number PU11-701.
Second.
Just a note to the part that you gentlemen have in front of you, it's actually December 12th of 2011. That change has already been corrected on the one we're going to sign. So in December of 2011, North Central filed the complaint alleging, among other things, that Otter Tail Power Company has begun construction and extension of their public utility plant and system to the transmission and distribution lines to the Sky Dancer Hotel and Casino without first acquiring approval of the North Dakota PSC. In January of 2012, Otter Tail filed the answer to the complaint. Basically, Otter Tail asserts that the Commission does not have regulatory authority over the tribe's determination of who will provide electric service to the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewas facility. We also received on February 17th a letter from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa confirming that the tribe is exercising its inherent sovereignty to determine which utility will provide electric services to the Sky Dancer Casino. So based on those filings, a public hearing in this matter will be held May 7th at 10 a.m. in our commission room to determine what the appropriate next step is for the commission.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Thank you, Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. KC1, I move the commission approve bond release number 1 for surface coal mining permit NACT9501 held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine to release all reclamation liabilities on 39.72 acres of land located in the northwest quarter of Section 5, T145 and R87W, Mercer County. No monetary release is being requested since the current bond amount is based on the worst-case reclamation condition at the Freedom Mine. This release will become effective May 29th, 2012, unless a formal hearing is requested.
Second.
As you can see, this is obviously a small portion of land. Only 2.3 acres of it were actually disturbed. None of it was disturbed, by the way, for mining itself, but there was a little bit. This 2.3 acres was affected in 1996 for construction of a water management diversion and stockpiling soil. Since that time, it's been obviously reclaimed. That the diversion was filled back in, the soil was respread, the area seeded for hayland, which is what it was previous to the mining. So, and the farmer still owns the land that owned it at the time that it was permitted.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Might be worth noting, however, that that does bring us to within 6 acres of complete final bond release, within 6 acres, I'm sorry, of 25,000 acres of final bond release since the program began. So we're making real progress. KC2, I move the commission adopt the order adopting the hearing officer's April 19, 2012 recommended findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommended order in the request of Plains Pipeline LP for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, a corridor certificate, and a route permit for the construction of its Nelson to Ross pipeline in Montrell County, North Dakota, case number PU-12-40.
Second.
As the motion states, this was a case that was heard by a law judge. I think Judge Holberg heard this case in Stanley. It is about 17 miles of pipeline that would carry 47,000 barrels per day. It says, again, it's officially Nelson to Ross. The gathering facility is just south of Highway 2, just on the east, maybe half a mile or so east of Stanley. Ross is actually Manitow, which is a little town just west of Ross. And this is one of those systems that's sort of a midstream. It takes from the gathering line to a rail facility at Manitow that is owned by Plains. And, of course, from there, the oil will be taken to market. 47,000 barrels per day represents, as a basic rule of thumb, enough oil to run, to require 235 trucks. If you look at that particular route, and the reason I'm spending a little time describing this one is because this is a really good example of the trucks off the road scenario. This represents 235 trucks, almost all of which would travel on Highway 2 through the towns of Stanley and Ross on their way to the rail terminal. That's a 13-mile stretch of Highway 2, roughly, so I did the calculation for anybody that can't figure out real easy math. It's 2,655 truck miles. And, you know, we often refer to trucks off the road when we talk about pipelines, and we sometimes put it in the context of transmission lines, but it's really these midstream lines that really provide the relief to the highway. So, again, you know, 235 trucks off of Highway 2 going through a couple of communities, pretty significant project. All in all, the plan for this project is to be in service by the end of this year. And I know that Dave wants to know how much it's going to cost. It's anticipated cost roughly $13.6 million.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And KC3, finally, is just administrative work here. I move the Commission submit the 2013 Administration and Enforcement Grant application to the Office of Surface Mining to request federal funds for the coal regulatory program for the next grant period that runs from July 1st, 2012 to June 30th, 2013.
Second.
Every year we apply for the grant, and this year's grant is a total amount of the application, which includes the state share, is $1,316,878, which includes both direct and indirect costs. Of the total, the federal share is $842,802, and the state share is $474,076, which creates calculates out into a split of 64% federal and 36% state based on the Office of Surface Mining's federal lands funding formula, and which of course takes into account the federal coal acreage and existing permits and applications that will permit new acreage. So it also reflects salary levels that are consistent with our state law and in our state budget every year. So everything's in order. As always, I anticipate that we'd be successful in the application and that our very good coal and reclamation program would continue as funded.
All in favor?
Aye. That ends items in my portfolio.
Very good. The printed agenda is available. You'll notice it's 3 weeks before our next commission meeting, May 16th, Wednesday at 10 a.m. We have three formal hearings of note prior to that. Commission meeting tomorrow, Thursday, April 26th. The commission will be in Williston for the Vantage Pipeline USLP Natural Gas Liquids Pipeline in Williamson Divide County siting application. Monday, April 30th, an administrative law judge will be handling Hess Corporation NGL Pipeline in Williams County. And then Friday, May 4th, the commission will be in Mandan at the Mandan City Commission meeting room for the Elite Clean Energy 100 Megawatt Clean Energy Number 1 Wind Project in Mercer and Morton Counties. With that, are there any questions?
About the power line, from what source is the customers who are going to be served by this power line, from what source are they getting their power presently?
Well, presently they get it from the same unit that they'll be getting it from eventually once this is built. But what it does, as you probably remember from past discussions, is the Milton R. Young is a generating station which is has historically been co-owned by Minn Kota and Minnesota Power. Minnesota Power, I can't remember the dates exactly of how the turnover is happening. Kevin O'Brien might be able to, but it'll be transitioning away from Minnesota Power, the Milton R. Young station. And the power from that, which is the lignite mine mouth coal operation, will be exclusively going to Minn Kota. Currently, that power goes over primarily a DC line that feeds into northern Minnesota. That line is being taken over by Minnesota Power and will be exclusively run by Minnesota Power. So to keep the and then they're developing wind resources. One of them is that hearing that we've got coming up in a couple of weeks in Mandan. So they're developing wind power in the central part of the state. Minnesota Power is. Minn Kota will be getting its power from the Milton R. Young station. And so to accommodate the transitioning of that DC line away from the coal plant, they need to build a new line from Center to Grand Forks, the heart of their service territory. It also has a secondary benefit, as I indicated, of boosting reliability for that part of the state.
If I understand you correctly, the Milton R. Young station is supplying the power
in part, it's part of Minn Kota's resource mix today.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say will become an even more important part of Minn Kota's resource mix in the future because they'll be the sole operator and beneficiary of it.
Obviously, while it becomes more important to Minn Kota Power, it's obviously its impact on Minnesota Power is diluted by this fact. The interesting thing to see will be how Minnesota Power fills the full capacity of that DC line going into Duluth with wind, especially depending on how the production tax credit gets handled in the next Congress.
We've even seen some discussion around the state of natural gas to electricity. There could be natural gas to electricity plants popping up in that region as well. So it'll be interesting to see what new generation might come online.
Can you tell me why the advanced determination of prudence case for Otter Tail in Montana and Dakota was withdrawn?
Oh, sure. It's just not ready for prime time yet. We had a work session, within a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. There were some issues that the commission wanted to more fully flesh out. I think it's fair to say the settlement, we weren't entirely comfortable with some of the terms of the settlement, so the commission is writing its own order. I think in large part that's probably ready, but we need a work session just to talk about it before we vote on it.
The Meadowlark Wind Project, you mentioned the efficiency factor. What is a typical efficiency factor? Because you mentioned that this one's
54%.
It's 54%. Yeah, what was the term you used?
Capacity factor is just what percentage of the time is the generating facility producing its full nameplate value. So you have a 102 megawatt wind farm. If it's got a 54% capacity factor, it's a little over 50 megawatt, a little 52 megawatts, something like that. The 54% for a wind facility is very, very good. Some of it relates to the really outstanding wind resource that we have in North Dakota. Some of it relates to increasing technology in the turbines themselves. When we first started hearing about capacity factors in North Dakota, utilities and others in the field would be excited about 40% capacity factors, which was a lot better than you were getting anywhere else. In recent wind farms that we've had in North Dakota, both operating experience as well as proposed wind farms, they're closer to that 50% range, which for an intermittent resource is very, very good. The importance of that is it makes the economics of the wind resource much, much better. If you could get 50% capacity factors anywhere, you wouldn't be building long-haul transmission lines to get wind from the Great Plains into load centers. You'd build them closer to the load center. If you have great capacity factors, it makes the building of transmission affordable because the overall delivered cost then becomes much more affordable.
Just so that I'm clear, the 54%, what is a more typical capacity factor for what we have presently?
Well, in North Dakota, that's...
Or what's a more typical industry capacity factor?
Oh, if you're talking about a coal plant, it's north of 90%.
I'm talking about for wind-generated energy.
Oh, for a wind generator, it's very dependent on where it's located. In the Great Plains, 40 to 50% is definitely doable in a lot of locations. If you were in the southeast, I don't know, 20%. I mean, it's just a fraction of it. As you go further east into Minnesota, they're not quite as good. If you go further east yet, it tends to be even worse yet.
What do you have a knowledge of the capacity factors in Minnesota? What a representative figure would be?
I think it'd be very dependent. If you're on the Buffalo Ridge, they're probably quite good. I don't know if they're quite to 50%, but. That's why you see a lot built on the Buffalo Ridge in Minnesota. You don't see a lot in the Iron Range. It's all very dependent.
Where in McHenry County is this project, please?
It's in the very southwest corner of McHenry County. In fact, it's just tucked in that little corner.
Okay.
What's unique, Dale, is that we've seen 10% jump in this in the last couple of years in North Dakota. So that, I think, is what really jumped out at these hearings. We've asked that what they're modeling, if that's actually true, because it's a big jump in a short period of time for the same region.
What's that attributed to?
Well, that's what the questions we have in the hearing. I think it's a combination, like Tony said, of just better understanding of what the technology is, just better placement of the towers, just a lot of different factors. But the end state, it's better for the customer.
The science of micrositing is quite a... Yeah, it's quite impressive.
It's quite sophisticated.
We ask about it, and so I mean, not only is it site specific, so you're comparing different regions. Even within North Dakota, there are areas that wouldn't get close to this. And the Coteau region and the Prairie Potholes and the Missouri Escarpment are much better than in the middle of the Red River Valley. And so, first you pick out regions, and then you get into very specific micrositing of the turbine itself, and even within a given wind field, it can be very specific to that site. And then there's technology with the blades and the turbines themselves where they can pitch the blades a little bit to increase the efficiency out of the turbine. So it's the engineering of it is improving, too.
Yeah, you've seen bigger turbines that start at lower wind speeds, for example, and are capable of continuing to run at higher wind speeds. So, you know, the turbine itself becomes much more efficient. I do think, though, another part of it is that we now have 1,500 megawatts, roughly, of nameplate capacity actually under construction, and we're less dependent on meteorological tower data and have real information that I think is also I've noticed that most of the wind farms have actually produced at a higher level than they were expected to produce at. And so, you know, it just may be that that the science is catching up and giving us more clear information.
What confused me a little bit was that you mentioned that this there's been this jump in the last year, and it made me think, well, are they out there installing new turbines or?
It's just in the hearings. They'll testify a year ago that at 42%. Now they're testifying 50-some percent, so we're asking the questions, and I think it's a combination of they're more confident testifying to the higher data, and there are just better improvements.
So it's just a function of operational experience rather than, like, equipment changes or?
I think it's all of the above. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that bears noting, too, though, while capacity factor is important, and increasing capacity factor is very important to the economics of the wind farm itself, we shouldn't confuse it with dispatchable power. I mean, these are on average, this is what the wind farm is running. It is still an intermittent resource, which means you can't, without close to 100% certainty, dispatch it on the day exactly when you need it because you don't know if the wind itself will be running. And that's something that, as of today, because of technology and the intermittent resource or nature of the resource, they can't overcome yet.
I guess my understanding was when you talked about the capacity factors, this is what it runs at. It's optimal. Yeah, it's average.
On average, output. Over the course of whatever your period is, probably a year, it's expected to produce, in this case, just over 50% of its nameplate value.
Now, if all that, if half of that nameplate value is that capacity is generating in the shoulder seasons and when you least need electricity, then it doesn't really have all that much value. There's a lot of factors are going to determining it. As Tony said, the dispatchability issue helps determine its impact on reliability, as an example.
Dakota Midland, how large is that elevator?
Sue, do you recall off the top of your head? 300,000.
300,000 bushels? And it was flooded?
Yeah, I mean, this is another unfortunate victim of the Minot flood. The facility is one that the board of directors determined would be too expensive to repair, so they're relinquishing their license.
And how long has it been not operating? Do you know?
Since the flood.
Okay. So it basically went out. It hasn't operated. Okay.
Right.
It hasn't operated since the flood. Do you know when they made the determination that they were going to go out of business?
When the board actually made that call, I don't know. According to Sue, we got the request last month. I don't know if they're doing any roving grain buyer activities or anything. So they're not doing any. Okay.
Okay. Can you explain the master meter rule? what we're wavered from.
You know, it's been an interesting one over since.
Because it's just my recollection that there's been periodic discussion about whether this rule
does,
is worthwhile. That's why Tony is smirking.
I used to be on the losing end of the
rule. Yeah.
Right, that's why the rule change of Brian.
We're moving forward with the rule change in anticipation.
It allows the landlord to have one meter instead of all of the tenants have several meters, and that's got. That, first of all, in my mind, that's a landlord choice, in my view. But so the landlord then can share the costs, if you will, or the landlord will include the costs of the utility into the rent, and they can figure that out for themselves without having the company meter every tenant. In this case, of course, it's a commercial building, but in some cases it might be an apartment building. The argument sometimes against master metering, of course, is that if each tenant has their own meter and their own controls, then there's more of an incentive for efficiency. But, in contemporary times and with the technology that's available, especially in the conscientiousness of landlords, there's plenty of incentive, especially in a commercial building, to master meter.
I mean, is there...
You also have competition with natural gas, and you can have natural... You have master meters and natural gas. In this part of the country, of course, heating drives so much of the energy consumption that it... Having a master meter rule can cause some distortions.
Is a landlord now required to... I'm trying to remember what the requirement is.
They're required to get a waiver from us if they want to have a master meter.
Okay. And what do you...
Well, then they come in like they did in this case, and the building owner says why he wants to do this, and he showed us that it was a cost saving to do the master metering. The improvements in technology made it easier. The fact that the turnover of the building, the company would have been out there installing new meters all the time, so long-term cost would certainly have outweighed any short-term gain. And I don't know if there's a lot of proof that shows that by having individual meters that you're actually going to save cost.
So what do you all think about this rule that you have to come into you?
We're going folks to try to change that.
Okay.
Yeah, this one happened to be a commercial property. Sometimes we get them from residential properties that say, look, we want to market ourselves as an apartment complex that just has a flat fee for rent and utilities all rolled into one. Sometimes we get them from commercial properties, and typically what happens there is you have buildings where, I think as Brian noted, you have high turnover. They need flexibility because you may have some customers that need a little larger space, some a little smaller space, and so it helps them with that flexibility, and they don't have to keep rewiring the place with new meters.
The effort to change the master meter rule, where does that stand?
We'll put that in a larger block of a rules change that we're submitting. We actually have some going through right now on other parts of the commission. So actually, Annette, we talked to her last week and going to submit some language and include it in a larger package.
I guess the reason I'm asking is I think I've heard this before about, well, yeah, we're going to talk about the master meter rule, we're going to change it or whatnot, and it seems like...
This is the first time we've actually had a staff member work on the rule, though, we're making progress.
It seems like PSC vague.
It is one of those things that only comes up whenever there's a case in front of us, and we haven't had one for a while, but...
Okay.
Put it this way, as legislative leaders like to say, this time we have the votes.
but for how, given the state of flux of the Public Service Commission, for how long are you going to have the votes, or how long are you going to have enough votes?
We'll move quickly.
Okay.
I jump in on BK6, the North Central versus Otter Tail. Is this a, am I reading too much into it, or is this a TIA versus tribal sovereignty issue?
I think you hit the nail on the head. This is going to be exactly come down to that issue. In my mind, is we've got the companies have already filed that basically North Central says this is our service area and Otter Tail shouldn't be there, and Otter Tail says that they've been asked to do it, and the tribe says it's our right to ask who we want. So that's the issues I think that'll come down pretty quickly that day.
Have you run into this before?
I have not. We had a case that was working its way through on the Devil's Lake outlet that was not on tribal land but similar on jurisdiction, and that got itself worked out.
There have been similar cases, I think, prior to any of us being on the commission, however. I can't remember the...
Same utilities, actually.
Yeah, same utilities. I can't remember if it was in Belcourt or if it was on Spirit Lake. I think it was in Spirit Lake before. But
Fort Dunn.
Well, you're right, Dave. The tribal sovereignty is the one issue that I think blurs it quickly, because if that wasn't the case, pretty cut and dried, I think, in some cases.
Has the utility gone ahead and built service already?
It's my understanding there's been construction that's taken place.
I think they've admitted that.
Yeah. I live up in that area, so I heard about this many different sources.
Well, I guess my understanding is, and it may be incorrect, is that service has been built and, in fact, it is being provided. Is that incorrect?
I believe that's correct for the new buildings. There's shared services up there because North Central is serving majority of the load. The new load is what Otter Tail is providing service to. And the questions at hand was did they have to ask us to do that?
And the new load meeting the expanded hotel.
Exactly. Okay.
And essentially the tribe is asserting that we choose, because we are a sovereign nation, we choose the utility provider that we would like to have, and you guys can butt out.
That's the arguments that we'll hear.
Okay.
What will be interesting to see is the tribes have not officially filed as to be part of this case right now. So that'll be interesting, because right now it's just set up between North Central and Otter Tail, and we have their filing. But that's why I'm anxious to hear this May 7th. We'll see how it plays.
I mean, do you think that by making a filing such as you described, they'd be admitting that you
well,
have anything to do with
themselves.
This?
They'd be submitting themselves to our authority, which would, of course, be in direct conflict with their argument. Yeah. So I'm not a lawyer, but I play one every other Wednesday, and so to me, it would seem like that would be a logical poor strategy. But you know,
yeah. I mean, I think they're from what I understand, they're. The Otter Tail's position is if it's a tribally owned business, if it's on tribal property itself, if it's on trust land, then the state would not have jurisdiction over that facility.
But at some point in time, we may have jurisdiction in a rate case, so there's so many variables here down the road.
Well, that's the other part. Is our jurisdiction over Otter Tail the most relevant thing? Anyway, we'll
see. Looking forward to the May 7th.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Okay, Kevin, the pronouncer of the town, M-A-N-I-T-O-U.
Manitou?
You said Manitou? And I've always heard Manitou. So,
well, let's
Manitou
with,
or Manitou?
Let's go with Manitou then. Okay. That's fine with me.
Close to Manitou.
Sounds closer Manitou. To a Canadian pronunciation, which is my, I suspect, where the town
Well, the folks who are up there, well, how do they pronounce it?
I don't know. I've never talked to anybody from Manitou.
Have you ever talked to anyone from, like, close to Manitou who
speaks
the word Manitou?
I have not. I've never heard reference to the town. In fact, the Ross Terminal has changed its name to the Manitou Terminal. It's referenced or referred to as the Ross Terminal in the letter of intent and the Manitou Terminal in the application. So
which do you think is, like, a cooler name, Ross?
Well, I think Manitou is a cooler name, and it's certainly more descriptive of where the facility is, so I think it's an appropriate name.
Okay. Yeah. Ross is really more a suburb of Manitou.
Yeah. It's a bedroom town, huh?
Right. Yeah, well, if there's a man camp close by, it could be one of the largest cities in North Dakota. Anyway.
Do you have any idea when you might eventually take up the advanced termination of prudence again?
Well, we're going to schedule the work session in a few minutes.
Okay.
So it'll be dependent on when we get the work session in. And I suspect if the commission is feeling pretty good about where the order sits, that it may be at the next meeting, which would be 3 weeks. But
okay.
But that may be incorrect, too. There's just a lot of moving parts in that one that I really want to go through the order with my colleagues on it.
Okay, any other questions? Anything else? We'll close this portion of the meeting and reconvene at 11 a.m.